you look in the bulletin, the drash title may sound a lot like an old classic Thanksgiving hymn. And that's okay, because guess what? We're less than 3 weeks away from Thanksgiving. And you see, faith may quite rightly be associated with our ancestors, and especially, though by no means exclusively, with Abraham. Because we've got Sarah, as we heard tonight, and later on comes Isaac and Rebekah and Rachel and Leah and Jacob and Joseph as the story continues to unfold through these texts that we'll be reading. You see, our forefathers and our foremothers, and by the way, that's spelled differently, our forefathers, F-O-R-E, and our foremothers, F-O-U-R, had tremendous faith. Sarah, Rebekah, and Rachel all had tremendous difficulty having any children at all. But God answered their prayer. And they each had miracle sons, Isaac and Jacob and Joseph. You know, actually that sounds almost like another story we recall at this season. They each share a theme in common, miracles and the supernatural birth of a son. But that's a different story. But it's all part of the wonderful ongoing story about the God of miracles and people of faith or faithfulness. But tonight's story begins, and as you heard, also ends with Abraham and with Sarah. Now let me review part of that story with you, because it seems that Abraham suddenly appears on the scene in Scripture. However, our ancient sages in the Midrash provide some of the backstory. It's an interesting backstory. In the Midrash, we're told, Rabbi Hiya said, Terah, Abraham's father, was a maker and merchant of idols. One time he went out, and so he appointed Abraham merchant in his place. Someone would come in wanting to buy an idol, and Abraham would say to the man, how old are you? He would say to Abraham, 50. Or some might say, 60. And Abraham would say to him, woe to that man who is 50 and wants to bow to an idol just one day old. The man would be embarrassed and walk away. One time a woman came carrying a dish of fine flour in her hand. She said to him, take this and offer it before them, to them being the idols. So Abraham stood up, carrying a club in his hand, and he broke all of the idols. He then placed the club in the hand of the largest of them. When his father returned, he said to Abraham, why did you do all this to them? Abraham said to him, a woman came in carrying a dish of fine flour and said to me, take this and offer it before them. So I brought it before them. This idol said, I will eat first. And that idol said, I will eat first. And then the largest of them stood up and he took a club and broke them all. Terah said to Abraham, why are you fooling with me? Do they know anything? Abraham said to him, may your ears not hear what your mouth is saying. Great story. Whether it's accurate or not, it's still a great story. It helps provide some of the background for why God said to Abraham, Lech Lecha, now it's time to get going. It's time to move out. And we've looked at that passage before, but let me briefly summarize that for you, because that's how the story unfolds and gets us to where we are now. Their story, Abraham and Sarah's story, opens with God's command to Abraham and Sarah to make what we would call in modern terms Aliyah, to get going. And then God continues in that classic text, I will make you a great nation, I will bless you, I'll make your name great, you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and those who curse you I will curse. All the families of the earth shall be blessed through you. Here God is promising Abraham two very important things, among others. One is a national family, but he's also providing Abraham with a universal mandate. Back in the 18th century, a famous rabbi, the Vilna Gaon, suggests that the phrase usually translated, I shall curse, which is in Hebrew, or, he suggests that it means, I will show them light. Therefore, Israel is to be a light unto the nations, a kingdom of priests, teachers who bring the message of God to the world. And we know that because God told us that in Exodus 19. He reminded us of that in Isaiah chapter 42. And it fits with this mandate. Now, Abraham desperately requires a son for both of these mandates or missions. And so the barren couple, Abraham and Sarah, first place their hope, it appears, their hope for the future on Lot, Abraham's nephew. And the Bible records in the very next verse, following the blessing and the charge that I just quoted to you, "And Abraham went in accordance with the way the Lord spoke to him, and Lot went with him. And Abraham took Sarah his wife, and Lot the son of his brother, and all the wealth they had acquired." But it appears that Abraham's mission wasn't materialistic enough for Lot. He has no desire to perfect the world. He wants to possess it instead. So he leaves Abraham's land and Abraham's Lord in favor of the lush city of Sodom to pursue matter rather than mission, monetary values rather than a monumental vision. On the other hand, the great message of Abraham's new name is his acceptance of his, that, and in fact, that universal mission. So as the story continues, and Abraham called out there the name of the Lord. Interesting phrasing. It's a phrasing that is picked up elsewhere, because a very important aspect of this story is frequently pointed out by the rabbis, and I suggested this to you, I believe even last week. And it's illustrated in the passage from last week. Yeah. Abraham demonstrates the great significance of hospitality, reaching out to people, which we call kiruv. And concerning Abraham's hospitality and reaching out to people, or kiruv, we read in the Talmud, "And he called there on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God of the Word," or the world, rather, in a phrasing similar to what I just read to you from Genesis 13. Text goes on to say, "Reish Lakish said, read not, and he called, but instead read, he caused to call, meaning that our father Abraham caused the name of the Holy One to be called by the mouth of every passerby." Now, how did this come about? After travelers, whom he made his guests, had eaten and drunk, they stood up to bless him. He said to them, "Was it of mine that you ate? You ate of that which belongs to the everlasting God of the world. So thank, praise, and bless the one who spoke and the world came into being." End quote. It's a reflection on the text from last week. A benefit of hospitality in Karuv is that it brings blessing to those who practice it, but also to those who receive it. And that's especially important, I think, in our day and age. Then back in Genesis 15, we read of God's promise of an heir who will make Abraham's descendants light the world like the stars of heaven, which is why he tells them to count the stars of heaven. Quick aside, I just found out this week, and I think it came from something that Dr. Patrice sent me, that at that time, in those days, if you went outside to count the stars, you could probably count some 4,000 of them that would be visible at night. Now, I don't know if Abraham got up to 4,000 or not, but, you know, just to give you some background. Anyhow, back to our story. Abraham's descendants would light up the world like the stars of heaven. Now, the structure and content of this Torah portion, the beginning one, teach us why Lot cannot be considered a suitable heir for Abraham's mission. And so we must wait, interestingly enough, for many generations, in a sense, for Lot's return to the fold, in the person of his descendant Ruth, the offspring of Moab, the son born to Lot and his daughter. You remember Ruth, the great-grandma, or was she the great-great-grandma? I didn't work all that out of David. Apparently God, and this is important for our story here, has cosmic patience, and often so must we, if we are to be his emissaries and light up the world as his descendants. And Abraham and Sarah show us then how their faith and their faithfulness should enlighten us. You see, in the passage that was read to you this evening, also from last week, while God does not address Sarah directly in Genesis 17, God refers to her and changes Sarah's name just like Abraham's, with a parallel explanation when he says, "She shall give rise to nations, rulers of people shall issue from her." And when Abraham doubts Sarah's ability to bear children and suggests that God's covenant continue through Ishmael, God assures him that the covenant will in fact pass through Sarah's son, Isaac. So God makes it clear that not all of Abraham's descendants are part of this covenant, only the ones of Sarah. This underscores Sarah's crucial role. It makes Sarah and Abraham equal partners then in the covenant. In a sense then, the greatest sign of this covenant is the fulfillment of God's amazing promise that Sarah will bear a child. And so we read the reflection found in the book of Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 11. "By faith, even Sarah, who was past age, was enabled to bear children because she considered him faithful who had made the promise." So let's summarize several lessons from Abraham's and Sarah's lives, particularly as reflected for us in Hebrews chapter 11. And to summarize the story there, faith involves, right from the outset, what we might call responsiveness or faithfulness. Despite other inducements and influences, for example, the prosperity and position Abraham had in Ur, or the comfort and convenience later on in Egypt, they turned their backs on it. And they did so despite uncertainty. And the text in Hebrews says, not knowing where they were going. In other words, they did not lay down any preconditions. Somewhat in contrast to our own, perhaps modern motto, be sure you know what you're getting into. And, you know, usually that's a really good motto to have. But that's not what drove Abraham and Sarah. You know, there was this guy on Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco. We saw a seafood restaurant and a sign on the specials board which read, "Big lobster tails, $5 each." Amazed at this great value, he said to the waitress, "$5 each for lobster tails? Is that correct?" "Yes," she said. "It's our special, just for today." "Well," he said, "they must be little lobster tails." "No," she replied, "they're really big." "Are you sure they aren't green lobster tails and a little bit tough?" "No," she said, "they are really big red lobster tails. Big red lobster tails, $5 each." He said again, even more amazed. "They must be old lobster tails." "No, they're definitely today's," she says. "Today's big red lobster tails for $5 each," he repeated, astounded. "Yes," she insisted. "Well, here's my $5, he said. "I'll take one." So she took the money, led him to a table where she invited him to sit down, and then she sat down next to him, put her hand on his shoulder, leaned close to him, and said very dramatically, "Once upon a time, there was a really big red lobster." Well, yes, there are times that you should know what you're getting into. On the other hand, Abraham and Sarah's faith enabled them to follow God and energize their faithfulness despite the uncertainty, and it made it possible for them to face uncertainty. Because, you see, faith also tolerates God's paradoxes. Hebrews reflects on it this way. It was the land of promise, and yet it was a foreign land. Very similar to our phrase found in our text. Abraham was ger v'toshav. He was a stranger, and yet a resident. Key phrase. So Abraham and Sarah were promised the land, and yet they waited, and they watched, and they waited, and they watched. They were patient. They didn't throw their faith overboard because it didn't happen when they wanted, on their schedules. They allowed God to work His plan in His way, in His time. They kept going despite obstacles. Because faith rests in God's promises. And so the text says they considered Him faithful, the one who made the promises. They rested in what God told them, in this case a child. And they waited. And they waited. Over 25 years they waited, trusting God, resting in God's faithfulness, despite the impossibility of the situation. The rabbi of old put it together this way, Romans chapter 4. "Against all hope, Nevertheless, Abraham in hope believed. Without weakening in his faith, he faced the fact that his body was as good as dead, since he was about 100 years old, and that Sarah's womb was also dead. Yet he did not waver through unbelief regarding the promise of God, even though it was impossible. But he was strengthened in his faith, and he trusted God, being fully persuaded that what God promised, that he would perform. Faith rests in God's promises. It certainly did for them. Faith also means, and this is important, especially in our day and age, trusting God in and through his tests. Remember, Isaac was the promise fulfilled. We read about this last week. And now God asks that he be sacrificed. So after all that waiting, the promise is about to be extinguished. This part of the story reminds us that tests are for our greatest benefit, for our specially designed good. They are part of God's purpose. Because as James and Peter say in their letters, these things develop perseverance, enhance our completeness and our maturity. It's as if we're being refined to become or to come across as more genuine. This part of the story also reminds us that we must trust God even if we can't trace Him. We must trust God even if we can't trace Him. So to summarize these lessons from responsiveness to God in Abraham and Sarah's life, we need to tolerate God's paradoxes. We need to rest in God's promises. We need to trust God in and through His tests. What this is talking about is an active faith. It's a reflexive faith. Reflexive. You know the story. You're sitting in the doctor's office, and he comes along with that little hammer, you know, and taps the knee. An instant response or reflex. That's supposed to happen. Well, in one sense, that's part of faith and how we should be responding. So faith is active. Faith is reflexive in that sense. It's an immediate response to God despite anything that might disrupt. I got it, didn't I? Okay, then we can continue. And their active, reflexive, faithful responsiveness to God helps explain the fullness of their lives, which our text for tonight indicates. You wondered when I get to the text for tonight? You did it. But we have to get the background. It begins, chapter 23:1. These were the years of Sarah's life. And so the great rabbi of the Middle Ages, Rashi, extrapolates to say that all of Sarah's years were equally good. And then a little later in the text, Genesis 24:1 then adds, Abraham was now old, advanced in days. The rabbis at this point ask the question, why does the Torah add at this point, advanced in days? And the answer they give is this, that Abraham was able to recount what he did each day of his life. And then as part of the concluding reading that you heard, Genesis 25:7 tells us, these are the days of the years of Abraham's life. And our traditions tell us that while most people's lives can be measured in years, Abraham's life could be measured in days. However, understanding the story well, the traditions understand, as we should understand, that like Sarah, Abraham certainly did not have it easy. So why does the tradition then say that all of Sarah's years were equally good and that Abraham lived every day to the fullest? Aren't they taking into account the days and years in harsh living conditions? Well, the idea is that a full, well-lived life is not a life of perfection or comfort, but it is a life of following God and His ways. Abraham and Sarah lived full and meaningful lives because they said yes to God at every turn. No minute was wasted because they were seeking to do the right thing. No minute was wasted in their lives because they were, in fact, seeking to do the right thing and to be on the path that God had for them. And even if they messed it up or it was challenging, they continued. The question at this point, of course, arises for us. Are we people such as Abraham and Sarah? The well-known Reform rabbi and scholar, Arnold Jacob Wolff, puts it this way. Quote, "How you know God's will for you and whether you are able to do God's will are difficult questions, but they are secondary to the belief that when you know, however you know God's will, there is no real choice about performing it. There's only obedience or sin." End quote. Or I would phrase it, faithfulness or failure. If we have Abraham's and Sarah's kind of faith, then we will in fact respond. And if we don't respond to God as a habit of life, let's not deceive ourselves. We don't then have the faith of our forefathers and foremothers. We don't have the faith of Abraham or Sarah or Isaac or Rebecca or later Jacob and Rachel and Leah and even Joseph and Moses. Our task is to follow in the footsteps of the faithfulness of our fathers and our mothers. And it is our choice. Take the next minute or so to reflect on that in quiet.